Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. Help find your own truth by exploring perspectives you won't find in the mainstream on some of life's biggest mysteries. Whether it's grand conspiracies, breakaway societies, UFOs, ancient civilizations, lost wisdom, as well as the paranormal, all at your fingertips. Stream videos anywhere from your living room or on the go with access to over 7,000 titles, all available to you with a monthly plan for only $9.95 a month. If you sign up now, the first month is only 99 cents. And there are multiple plans to choose from, including a three-month plan and an annual plan. If you enjoy expanding your perspective, then you'll enjoy Gaia.com. 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 Everybody, it is me, Master of Ceremonies Cam Hale, and thank you for joining us again here on Expanded Perspectives. And sitting with me, as always, all of you know, we're in here laughing about different ways we ought to do the intro. It's Mr. Kyle Filio-Filson. He's got a smile on his face laughing now.
How's it going, everybody? I'm super thrilled to be here. Just come back from Luke's birthday party yesterday. It went off without a hitch. It was amazing. The kids had fun. A lot more kids showed up than we thought. This happens all the time.
Did you run out of Cristal?
Yeah, we did. We were popping bottles and bottle service and everything. Like, literally bottle service. Like, I was holding my niece. She's like 2 months old.
Right.
Yeah, one of those pacifiers where it's see-through so it looks like a catfish on the other end of it. I love those.
Yeah, you're like, what the? I like the ones with the mustaches where they put them in. It looks like the kid's got the big mustache. I love that.
Yeah, that's it was a good time. The kids had a blast. And I forgot what I was saying. Oh, this happens all the time. You have, like, send out invitations for people to RSVP. And this isn't just with kids' birthdays parties. This is with almost any event. I don't understand all the people that don't do that, but then they always show up. I'm like, did you not? Why didn't you RSVP? That's the whole point of me sending that to you.
Yes.
But they do it every time.
There ain't no cupcakes for me because you didn't tell me you was coming, dumb.
So we ran out. But luckily, the kids had so much time jumping around and all these obstacles and stuff that they didn't really seem to care. They didn't care about eating.
Yeah.
I just bought a bunch of candy and threw it out there.
Just for nothing, yeah. What you should have done, and I'm going to tell you this after having two kids that are much older now, and I'll tell you how to beat that, okay?
Okay.
All you do is buy tubs of cake icing. Those tubs of cake icing and plastic spoons. Just put it, that's all it is. They just want color and sugar, and that's it. It's sweet, and you don't have to buy the cupcake. Cupcake's just a waste of time. So just go buy you 6 or 8 tubs of cake icing and put them out there with spoons in them, and they just eat out of them what they want, like it's ice cream, except it doesn't melt, and then you're on and it's rocking.
It's funny you say that. I didn't know you were going to tell me this story, because a day prior to the party, Dalee was baking all kinds of cupcakes for the party,
mm-hmm.
and she went in the go get icing out for the thing, and it was half gone. She's like, son of a gun. The bread, at some point, I go, how long have you owned that? And she's like, well, it's been in there for like 2 months. Some point along the line, they went in there and opened that up and ate half the frosting.
Got their spoon. It was just like, this will work.
It's like, there's no telling how many things are half eaten if you go into the pantry or anything else in this house.
You're going to have to start going through it now. Like, you're searching up and you're doing like a crime scene investigation because you know they've been in there going after it.
And she's like, I can't believe they would do that. I was like, I can.
Of course I can.
It's a thing of icing. Why wouldn't they try to eat it?
That explains a lot. Whenever they're going wild in the middle of the night, that explains an awful lot.
Right? Well, let's get into the news, folks. Check this out. This is pretty cool. This comes from Ancient Origins. Archaeologists have uncovered a 9,000-year-old underwater stone settlement. 6 years ago, divers discovered the oldest known stationary fish traps in northern Europe off the coast of southern Sweden. And since then, researchers at Lund University in Sweden have uncovered an exceptionally well-preserved Stone Age site, which they believe the location was a lagoon environment at one time where Mesolithic humans lived during certain portions of the year. Although these some spectacular finds include a 9,000-year-old pickaxe made out of elk antlers.
That's awesome.
Right? They discovered mass fishing nets and things like that. And they think that this place was a semi-permanent settlement. Now, there's a person named Anton Hansen, who's a PhD student at Lund University. And as a geologist, he went on and says, "We want to recreate this area to understand exactly how it looked. Was it warm or was it cold? And how did the environment change over time?" They talked about how changes in sea level have allowed findings to be preserved deep below the surface of Hanau Bay in the Baltic Sea. Now, these researchers, they've actually drilled down into the seabed and radiocarbon dated the core, and they've examined these diatoms and different types of pollen, and they've produced a state-of-the-art topographic map which reveals depths and variations of the land at that time. And he goes on to say that these sites have been known, but only through scattered finds. "We now have the technology for more detailed interpretations of the landscape. If you want to fully understand how humans dispersed from Africa and their way of life, we also have to find their settlements. And quite a few of these are underwater. The sea levels were much lower at that time. And of course, human beings always like to live on coastal sites." Mm-hmm. So this is something we talk about on the show all the time. And I always love this because it always makes you wonder, I wonder how much is under the water. And they keep finding this. You know, I think it's ridiculous that anybody thinks that this is all preposterous or made up, that this did not happen, this sea level rise. Because yeah. I meet people, they're like, "Well, there's no real proof that that happened." I'm like, "What are you talking about? What do you mean there's not proof?" They keep finding these underwater sites.
Yes.
That were there.
Yeah.
And so I love it when they find this. I would love to have a pickaxe made of elk antlers.
That was over 9,000 years old.
How cool is that?
That would be amazing,
right?
That would be amazing.
Very interesting.
If anybody's interested in any more of the talk about this and you haven't already listened, I would urge you to listen to Joe Rogan's newest interview with Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson, where Randall goes into more depth about all of this. And into the thawing of the last ice age and the meteorite that caused it and the flooding and how fast and how much that actually rose. And you could understand how things would be consumed. We're talking 400-foot sea level rises very quickly. So you're talking about, you know, large villages could have easily been consumed and large megalithic sites. And that's another reason, as we talk about, why they're finding them.
Well, and I think a lot of people don't understand that it wasn't just a problem that happened here in North America when this thing struck. Mm-hmm. Because I think it struck 2 mile deep ice, right, up in the Arctic.
Yeah.
What happens is it puts all that moisture and water in the air. So it actually causes a global problem.
Yes.
And this is what's responsible for the Younger Dryas. And I don't think there's any doubt that this is what's going on. What's crazy is geologists and stuff like that, a lot of them are just, they're not denying it. They just don't acknowledge it. And
they don't
want to
get
involved.
When
you look at these aerial photographs that they've put together, I mean, there's no doubt. There's no doubt in my mind. And it looks that Randall Carlson's even convinced Graham Hancock, who apparently is already working on another book.
Yes. That's going to be based here in North America this time.
Yeah. I mean, I love that kind of stuff.
It's going to be really, really unique. Brett, I know that you like the Marco Polo show on Netflix, right?
I thought it was awesome.
Yeah, I love it too and all that stuff. So that's, you know, we've got into the Mongols. We've talked about it from Dan Carlin's, which now I don't think it's for free. You actually have to go to buy those episodes now.
Dude, they're like
$1 a piece.
99 cents,
They're amazing.
Genghis
anyway,
Khan.
Yeah. I found this. Now, this comes from the Siberian Times, okay? Now, it says that they found a burial site of the Siberian Robin Hood. And, of course, it's archery, so I was drawn in instantaneously. But they found a wooden sarcophagus, what they call a unique quiver with arrows in it and iron tips, and they found it stuffed into a hole in a cliff there. Now, two local residents accidentally stumbled across this burial site, and it was close to the village of Kokoroya. And this is which contains the bones of an adult man, his birch bark quiver, arrow shafts, and iron arrow heads. Also, intricate ornaments and utensils made from the roots of trees as well as the remnants of silk ribbons were found in this whole thing.
That's cool.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Now, when they say it's a sophisticated quiver, when they go into this unique and sophisticated quiver they keep talking about, they say it's because it has pockets, what they believe were for different types of arrows. So maybe you have a small game arrow, a large game arrow.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Exactly. Now, archaeologists have not yet, they said, secured the permission to open this wooden sarcophagus. But the locals who found it, of course, did. They didn't know. They just looked in it. They said it does contain bones, and they believe they also saw the bow itself still inside there. Now, there's a doctor that's involved with this whole thing. Dr. Nikita Konstantinov, and he's the head of the museum of the Gorno-Altaysk State University, said that, at the moment, we have a birch bark quiver, two bone plates with elaborate ornaments, iron arrowheads, wooden arrow shafts, birch bark linings for a saddle, the remains of a ribbon, likely silk, and what is left of a leather strap. Initially, we thought that the bone plates were details of the bow, but they turned out to be the decorations of the quiver. Says that the warrior is suspected to be of Mongolian origin. There are no similar quivers found in our region. This is unique for the Altai. It was wrapped in silk ribbons when he was buried. The leather strap was used for attaching the quiver to the belt, we believe. And judging by the shape of the arrowheads, I would say the owner was a warrior, but they could also be used for hunting. Now, there's a ton. Vasily Onenshev is the director of the Agency for Cultural and Historical Heritage of the Altai Republic, and they interviewed him. And he says that the quiver is a very interesting one. It has separate pockets for different types of arrows. And he goes on to say that this quiver is a great find because it's very well preserved, and it will be important to examine it more thoroughly because they're trying to understand this, the construction, because they've not seen one like this.
Right, yeah.
Which it could easily be a one-off. Maybe this dude didn't like just the... So he just kind of... You know, he pimped his ride, and he just fixed up his own quiver the way he liked it. Or could it be a different branch of Mongolian archers, and this is something that's, you know, inherently just theirs? So that's what they're really looking into it for. Now, they're talking about this. Now, Dr. Ozensev says this. He says, sadly, we cannot go and excavate the grave immediately. We need to have a special permission for work. Excavations are allowed in the period form from April 1st to November 1st. So as soon as we get all the permits, they're going to go back to the grave and they're going to go to work in it. It says this, we are doing all we can to ensure the safety of the grave in winter and to ensure the security of other archaeological objects. I have many questions to how these items were found. The story was that the locals found the grave in a hole in a cliff and took some items from there. But I am not completely sure how they have not unearthed it. So we need to check it out, this whole thing, thoroughly. So you go into this. Then they start talking. They've talked to Dr. Alexei Tishkin, and it's an Altai researcher there. And it says that when the Mongolian tribes came to the Altai, previously Turk traditions were completely forgotten.
Yeah.
So part of the local population was assimilated or destroyed. So that they believe that this has kind of sprang up on its own. So that's what they're looking into. But nonetheless, it's very interesting. And I also didn't know that Robin Hood played such a big part in Russia until finding this. And then I kind of looked at other branches, and they actually made, the Soviet Union made a Robin Hood story about this. And it's a
separate Robin Hood, right? Separate from the one that took place in England.
They're just using that as a reference.
Okay.
There was never real Robin Hood in Russia. What they're talking about, though, is due to
an archer that they found.
Well, but due to the communist ideology, the common folk of Russia love the story of Robin Hood because he robs from the rich and he gives to the poor. And they actually made a movie about it back in the 70s called The Arrows of Robin Hood. That was a Russian version of Robin Hood.
Right.
So it's very interesting that I didn't know that even that stretch, it still made its way over there in the 70s. Behind the Iron Curtain, that's still something that they really liked and believed in. But they're just using that as a name because of all the archers. But archery's a big deal in the Altai and in the Mongolian history and all that. Archery was a big, big deal.
Very big deal. And I think people love the story of Robin Hood in so many cultures. I mean, even Pablo Escobar was kind of Robin Hood-like.
Yeah, in a way, yeah.
I mean, he also brutally murdered people. Yeah. But he also was, you know, giving his money to the poor and building, you know, these towns and things like that. All the people there loved him.
Right? Yeah, but he built a great football fields and nice houses yeah. and had the best yayo on the block.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Moving on, this is pretty cool. Everybody, you know, constantly writes the show. Everybody likes dog man sightings. And I found two really interesting ones that were posted this week. One was by David Weatherly over on Two Crows Paranormal. The other one was by Lon Strickler on Phantoms and Monsters. These were both from two different time periods. One took place in 1951. One took place in 1972. So check these out. This is pretty cool. This first one took place in 1951 near Eureka, California, at a spot near the Eel River, which is above Eureka, at the end of a meadow near the river's edge. It says, a family and the main witnesses were fishing on this river. They had camped in the vicinity for about 2 weeks and had poor luck when it came to the fishing. The main witness used to go for a short walk before breakfast because there was a very pretty meadow about a mile or two from their camp, and she used to love to see the mist rise off the grass, look at animals and bird watch and things. She was only about 10 years old at the time, and the world of nature was something which both fascinated and enthralled her. She entered this meadow and proceeded to cross it in order to reach a small knoll at the other side. When she approached the foot of the knoll, she heard a sound. It was the sound of something or someone walking. And she thought perhaps her little brother had followed her and was going to jump out and try to scare her. So she hollered, "All right, I know you're there." Needless to say, it was not her brother that appeared. Instead, it was a creature that she will never forget as long as she lives. The creature stepped out of the bushes, and she said she froze like a statue. He, or it, was about 7.5 to 8 foot tall. He was covered with brown stuff that looked more like soft down than fur. He had small eyes set close together and had a red look about them. His nose was very large and flat against his face. He had a large mouth with the strangest looking fangs she had ever seen. He made a horrible growling sound that she doesn't think could be imitated by any living thing. So she got out of there. She ran as fast as she could. And when she finally reached her camp, now winded, she stayed scared all the while they were there. The creature's form was that of a human, and he had hands and feet of enormous size, but still very human-looking. However, there was one thing that was the strangest and most frightening thing of all. He had on clothes. They were tattered and torn and barely covered him, but they were still there. Now, this original source comes from Albert Rosales, of course. And this account is pretty interesting. I like the way she described it. What could it be? She thought it was a little brother sneaking up on her, and it wasn't. And perhaps my most favorite description was not that, you know, when was it a dog man or whatever, but the fact that it had torn clothes on, almost as if it was a human that transformed
a werewolf
into this beast, right?
So dude, what that's else so awesome.
So this other one comes from a guy named Mickey in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky. And this was originally aired on Coast to Coast AM on October 21st, 2016. And this is what it says. In 1972, we lived in a town in northern Indiana, in the Muncie area. It was a real small town. I was 9 years old and my mom came and woke me up at 2 o'clock in the morning. There was this black creature on our front porch, and it was about the size of a large ape. It had a snout like a dog, and it would just scream these blood-curdling screams, and then it would start going, "Nar, nar, nar, nar," and then it would scream again. Now, I don't know anything about coonhounds, but my father always had coonhounds, and he worked the third shift, so he wasn't there most of the time. An old coonhound isn't really afraid of anything, and this time, they were cowering in their boxes. They wouldn't come out, no matter how hard I tried. My mom got me up because I was the oldest of 6 kids. We were watching it through the front door. It wasn't making any aggressive moves. It was just making those screams and making those noises. But she got the pistol anyways. And she said, "I'm not going to bother it unless it tries to come in the house." After about 2 hours, she got one of those Polaroid instant cameras they had back then, and she put it up to the window and she snapped a picture. Well, when the flash went off, this thing shot off the wall over the rail about 8 feet high into the front yard. We had the light on. About 8 feet into the front yard, it would shine. This thing, whatever it was, landed on all fours, jumped up, and took off. It was the fastest thing I ever saw. So that's an interesting story. The only thing that makes it sound like dog man is his description of the snout. But,
yeah.
You know, he also says it looked kind of like a large ape. So was this dog man or was this a Sasquatch? This isn't a problem. This is an idea of mine when it comes to these dog man sightings, you know, versus Sasquatch sightings. We have it in our idea what a Sasquatch is supposed to look like because of films like the Patterson-Gimlin film. You know, we also have an idea what a dog man's supposed to look like because of werewolf movies.
Mm-hmm.
But in all reality, could a lot of these be the same thing?
Yes.
Maybe, you know, we don't really know what a Sasquatch looks like because all we have are eyewitness accounts or, you know, footprints left behind. But until we get a body, I don't know. Or could it be different species, two separate species of Sasquatch or whatever, and each one looks a little different? You know, like you take a white-tailed deer from down here, it looks completely different than a white-tailed deer from Alberta.
Mm-hmm.
They're both the same species, but much, much different.
Yes.
So makes sense to me that if you're in Florida and you see a swamp ape, it's going to look a little bit different than something up in British Columbia.
Yes.
It only makes sense to me. So I don't know. I know that people love these dogman sightings, and I have to admit, they are pretty interesting.
Yes, I enjoy the heck out of them, because you always wonder, like, man, what are you mistakening that for? You know, it's like,
well, yeah, well, obviously, like, the first story where the thing had clothes on, yeah. I mean, that's obviously not a Sasquatch.
But I still like the fact that you still go, or she still goes back to the whole deal is, it could have been an ape. I love the fact, because they move. Because anytime we see something that large and hairy, instantly our mind jumps to, it looks like an ape.
But because that's the only thing you can relate it to.
That's exactly
right. And that's
right.
Exactly what your brain does, yeah. As a human being. It constantly is trying to fill in gaps if there's missing things. And
that's the only thing we can relate it to. That's it.
Yeah.
It's a giant ape. Brad, you know we talk about history on here all the time, and I know all y'all listening, y'all enjoy it. We've talked about hunting Hitler, and we've talked about Grey Wolf, and we've gone into all this stuff, and the Nazi ties to America and all that stuff. My bearded brother over there at Gizmodo, Matt Novak, wrote a little article a few weeks ago, folks, and I think this is very interesting, and it's something that you need to think about. He wrote that the Nazis kept a list of powerful American friends in Los Angeles, including the co-founder of UCLA. Now, he goes into talking about that in 1945, the FBI raided a warehouse in L.A. that was used for storage by the German consulate, and among these files, they found a collection of 3x5 index cards kept by the Nazi regime containing contact information for important people in Los Angeles. Now, folks, when I say contact information, I'm talking about names, addresses, and phone numbers of these people.
Hmm.
Not code words, not code names. We're talking like a Rolodex is what they had. So Matt's been looking into this. So he actually sent a FOIA act into the FBI, and he got a 5-page document about these cards. Now, he had previously stated in here that he'd requested all FBI documents on Norman Chandler. Now, he's the former publisher of the LA Times, who turns out in the late 1930s was chumming it up with the Nazis. So he went through all these archives, and he goes to digging, and he goes to finding things out about who was in there. And I'm going to give you a little bit of a rundown. In the entertainment industry, people on the index cards in 1945 included Jason Joy, the head of public relations at 20th Century Fox, Hans Peters, the art director at 20th Century Fox, who would move to MGM during World War II, and Henry Nordlinger from the MGM Research Department. Now, the file notes this, that Nordlinger will gladly furnish info to the German consulate. Now, it says that he was educated in Switzerland, but came to the U.S. in 1929. There, of course, he worked for MGM's research department for over a decade, and after World War II, he became Cecil B. DeMille's personal research consultant, working on movies like The Greatest Show on Earth and The Ten Commandments. The cards had plenty of members of academia as well, he writes, including Ernest C. Moore, the co-founder of UCLA, who in the 1930s called his university, this is a quote here, one of the worst hotbeds of campus communism in America. Yet, he's friends with the Nazis. Goes on that they also include this, Dr. M. Delbrook from the California Technical Institute, known as Caltech, and a number of professors from UCLA like Rolf Hoffman, Paul Paragold, Frank H. Reich, Alexander Graf von Werthen-Hoffenbroffen. I don't even know how you pronounce his last name, and I don't know why I take these things on. He goes on to talk about a ton of people that you wouldn't even expect, and here's another one. In the American industry there in L.A., the president of Lockheed, Robert Gross, was on the Nazis' contact list as well. Also, Mrs. R.W. Trueblood and Edwin Schollert of the LA Times was on there. Now, we talked about Norman Chandler. You go back, of course, was on the list because it says here, in quotes, royally entertained by Nazi regime when the publisher visited Germany. And it says that he honestly partied with them. That he was, yeah, that he was out there, and he's, of course, they go on talking about, you know, that he was peddling all this stuff on them. But he actually was rubbing elbows and straight partying with them. So you go in and you start looking at it, and you're like, man, that could explain a lot is they weren't alone. This wasn't an ideal that they had. They had other people over here that was kind of help laying the groundwork down for what they wanted over here also, which seems a lot like what goes on even now, is you've got people, just because you're in America doesn't mean they all believe the same way.
That's right, yeah.
You know, so that's kind of what so I don't know. I just thought it was crazy. I was like, man, like, could you imagine the president of Lockheed being a Nazi? Now, we're not saying he's a Nazi sympathizer. We're not saying any of this. We're just saying that all of this index cards and stuff, they were on there. So for all we know, maybe they were all clustered up. You know, we don't have any idea. They just talked about the people that contact information of important people in L.A. Maybe that contact info was, we need to keep an eye on that person. They're not with us. Or, you know, I don't know, maybe we feel like we can approach them. We're not, there's no slander here. We don't know if they were Nazi sympathizers or they weren't. We have no idea. But we know that those were the people that were on those contact cards. For what real reason?
We don't know.
You could go one way or the other. You could say it's for one. You could say it's for the other. If you want to know more, go read his article. You can really dig into that. But yeah, there's some funny stuff that was going on there to even have your name on a card. That'd be like them finding you on the hard drive of some ISIS cell or something.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's something you don't really want to be involved with. You know, it's one of those deals. It's like, wait a minute, what's your name popping up on here for?
Right.
That's when they come get you and they hold you indefinitely without charging you because they want to come talk to you. And then next thing you know, you're waterboarded and there's paper cutting between your toes and all that stuff. So that would be awesome.
Man, speaking of Nazis and stuff, you've been watching the new season of that Hunt for Hitler.
I have not. But I'm a huge fan of Tim Kennedy, but I just haven't watched
it. He's been on there a lot, Gerard Williams. And what's interesting is we were ahead of the curve on this. I mean, we did an interview with Gerard Williams concerning this exact thing over 3 years ago.
Well, it's back when we started.
If you like that television show, you might want to go back and check out our interview we did with Gerard Williams.
Yeah.
Because we read the book Grey Wolf. And I remember back then having no concept of this. I never heard of this. And I was blown away that apparently not only did Hitler escape and live on the rest of his days, but we were aware of it and kind of we bargained with the Nazis almost and seemed to get scientists. But anyways, that show is very interesting. And I get people constantly approaching me, whether through email or physical, face to face, like I was just at a family event not too long ago, and of course Dr. Powers again was asking, have you been watching that?
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, Mark, we talked with the guy that's on that show 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Very interesting stuff. So that show, I love that show.
Yeah, and Gerard's a great guy. I still talk to Gerard now. Facebook messages. He's a great dude, man. He is, and he's up to politics. Like, if I need to know anything or I have any questions because I don't know what's going on over in Europe, I just message Gerard. I'm like, dude, I don't know. And he'll, of course, he talks to you like he's your grandfather, and he's extremely knowledgeable. So he lays it all down for me where I'm an idiot like me. I'm like, oh, I got it now. Thanks. You know, I'm like, I understand. I'm picking up what you're putting down. Folks over here in the States, I know y'all are probably, a lot of you are going to do some traveling, a lot of flying, a lot of driving, a lot of going here, going there. There's something I'm going to cover. I'm going to give you some good time. So if you're flying or if you're driving and you've got a long drive ahead to go visit family and you're looking out the window into the darkness while you're traveling, I want you to keep your eyes out, folks, for some ghostly lights and ghostly orbs, because when we get back from the break, I'm going to touch on a few of these and some interesting stories that deal with ghost lights. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. Well, folks, like I alluded to, we're going to get into something that I don't know. Kyle, if I was to ask you, when you start thinking of ghosts, most people either think, most of them think of a poltergeist idea. You know, when you think of a ghost, you think of either seeing a physical, you know, apparition. You see something there or you see something moving, things like that. I don't know that many people think of lights, but every time I think of these strange orbs or these ghostly sightings of lightings, I always go back into what we set right here in this studio, and we drank quite a few beer and we talked with our brud Micah Hanks from the Grayling Report. And we talked about the Brown Mountain Lights. And we're supposed to go up there and go see him with him. And he's going to take us around. And, I mean, he's really dug deep into this whole thing. You know, and we even had him on as one of our very first interviews to talk to him and got into it with him, you know, and had him discuss the Brown Mountain Lights. I don't think a lot of people think of them that way. And I don't guess I really did until a few years ago. It was probably after talking to Micah of the fact that what if those, it's energy. You know, our body has electricity and our body has energy. What if that's what it is? What if what we're seeing is the ghostly leftovers of people? What if that's just a soul in purgatory? Whatever, however you believe, what if that's what this is? So we're going to get into these lights, not just at Brown Mountain. There's lights everywhere that we don't really know what they are, what caused them. We have theories on what they are, and some people have even claimed that they've proven this exactly what it is. And then there's some other interesting ones I'm going to get into this last case. But for those of you that don't know, the Brown Mountain lights, we'll touch base with that. It was first observed by a German engineer named Gerard de Brom, and it took place all the way back, they say, in 1771 there in Burke County, North Carolina. Now, when you talk about them, people see them, they say they're so bright you can see them for close to 20 miles away. But they usually stay around for, you know, up to 15 minutes when people see them. And they're a reddish color. Some people have even claimed they've seen some that are orange or a pink hue to them. But they're super famous. Like I said, folks, if you pull it up and just go to looking, man, check them out. They were even investigated, of course, by the U.S. Geological Survey. But Micah has gone up and talked about them. And he's talked about some strange stuff that happened to him up there on the mountains, too, with all that. So if you want to know more about that, you can go and, like I said, you can listen to our interviews. You can go find our interviews on YouTube about the Brown Mountain lights. Apparently, and I didn't even know about this, but in 77, there was an experiment conducted that they took a 50,000 candle power floodlight and they were shining it there towards Brown Mountain from 22 miles away. And the people doing the experiment saw a red circular light floating above the horizon. And this is what they concluded, that the refraction of ordinary lights were likely to blame for the Brown Mountain lights. They believe it's refracting and you're seeing basically headlights or just bright light, searchlight or something, anything that somebody's got going on. It's like I said, you know, maybe it is, but maybe that doesn't explain every sighting. So we get into what we have here in Texas and we start talking about Marfa, the Marfa lights. And you can even go check into this, folks, because the earliest basically sighting that they could find of this took place in 1883 by Robert Ellison. He's an old cowboy there, and he was actually herding cattle out in there and across the part of this Marfa Plain whenever he saw it. And then, of course, you go back into 1885. There was a sighting by Mr. Joe Humphreys and his wife, Anne, and they said that they had seen it, and there's some books written about it, of course. And then they published an account of these lights in 1957, back in July, in a magazine. And then again in 76, there was a book written called The Tales of Big Bend. And it actually talked the Big Bend area out there. And it actually talked about the Marfa lights. And there was even a photograph that was put in there by a rancher. A local rancher took a picture of what it is. But they're also known as the Marfa ghost lights. And you can see them up there near U.S. There's a route, Highway 67, right through there. And it's on the Mitchell Flat, which is east of Marfa. And you can go in there and look around. And a lot of people have called them UFOs. Of course, the ghost lights. It's funny because they even call them the Will-O-The-Wisps they get into.
I've always wanted to go down there and see that.
Yeah, my dad's seen them. My dad had told me when I was a young man, he would talk about that when they were out there rodeoing, that they had actually seen them before. But it goes back into the same thing. The theory around it suggests that it's nothing more than a reflection, atmospheric reflection of just that. Either what they're calling campfires, which now I'm sure is probably not near as much, but headlights, refraction of reflections of headlights out there that's bouncing them up, which to me is almost like, and I hate to say it, swamp gas. That's almost like the swamp gas explanation is. Yeah, it makes sense, but it still doesn't explain everything. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, come on now. Well, you jump forward into that and you get into the big thicket lights. And we have talked with the big thicket lights with Mike Mays, the Texas cryptid hunter. And he had actually brought that up and talked to us about it. And then I've got friends like we bring up in East Texas that have observed these big thicket lights. They call it the Light of Saratoga. And it's right there in the big thicket along Black Creek. There's an old ghost town called Bragg there in Southeast Texas. And of course, that's where it gets the name, the Bragg Road Light of Saratoga, or the Saratoga Light, or most everybody just calls it the Big Thicket Light. Story goes, of course, you're on a dirt road, and just out of nowhere, this big light appears with no explanation, just here it is. And this strange light, and it says it starts kind of like as a pinpoint back in there through the trees, and then it gets brighter and brighter and brighter, and then it dims, and then it goes away. And it'll change colors, yellows to whites. Some of them will even go back to that orangish pink hue. Some of them even say it's red, like you get in there and you get red. Which that would make sense if it was reflections, right? If you were seeing different lights reflecting, that would make sense. I get it. But some even go back to say that it moves back and forth. So it moves. So I'm like, well, I can understand it flaring up and going away in one spot if it was a car, because you would think it's, well, the only way it hits that horizon is a certain hill, then it goes away. If it's not, why would you look at it and then it's moving back and right. forth and back? That starts making you question, like, well, what could that be? Some people even claim that that's the reason it looks like that is it's nothing more than someone way on the horizon's got a lantern or a spotlight and they're moving it. You know, there's always these different theories because we don't know. So we have to put that out there. Strange thing is they was some Native Americans believed that it was actually something that they had reported seeing things out there. And this is what they said, that it's the phantom. It's a phantom Native Americans that allegedly attack people. And they also say that there's ape-like wild men in there, and that if you wander deep into the woods, that's what happens, is you'll get taken by these things that are out there that have these lights and do this. Like they're trying to lure you in. Yeah, it's pretty strange. We haven't been down there to look, but we're going to have to go. We need to hit Mike up. That's what we need to do. We need to get a hold of Mike, go to the Big Thicket, go out there and look on the Bragg Road, check all this stuff out. Another cool thing is our brothers and sisters down under, there in South Queensland, there's a place called the Min Min Lights down there. So we're not alone when you start talking about this. And it's another thing. They call them ULOs. And I like this, unidentified luminescent objects. And it's a light. And of course, it says it's got its name from the old Min Min pub. And it says it's a mail change down in this area, but it dates back to 1918. And it says this is where the legend starts from, that an unfortunate stockman who encountered the light soon after the Min Min shanty or hotel was burnt down. It says that he was riding, and I always get grief from everybody down under whenever I mispronounce these things. So get ready. Get your emails ready, folks. Warinda Station in Boolya? That's something to
Boolya. Sounds right.
Sounds close. But it says around 10 p.m. this stockman passed Min Min there, and they said this strange glow appeared right in the middle of the cemetery located near the hotel, and that it appeared to glow to the size of a small watermelon hovering there in the graveyard, and then it moved off in the same direction that this stockman was traveling. Of course, the guy riding his horse freaks out, takes off this towards Boolya, I guess, whatever it is. They're heading that way, and he tells the story that the light followed him all the way until he got right to the outskirts of town. And then it says, of course, the police and the locals in that area just thought he was an old drunk. It's like, look, that's not nothing real. This isn't real. Some sort of joke. You're just pulling my leg, which we always know. You know, who knows? Maybe he did see something.
Yeah,
I don't know. I know how terrifying it would be to think of anything. I mean, I scared the heck out of myself in my house the other night, just walking around in the dark. So I could only imagine out there riding my horse. But that brings us to the Tacky Ranch lights in Montana. Now, this comes from the Helena Daily Herald. Now, this was written back in 1881, and it was a witness recounts of these strange lights in the paper there in March, and they called it ghostly visitations, folks, and it was a strange and mysterious light that people had seen in the valley, and it was made, of course, this investigation by the Helena Scientific Club there in Montana, and what was written says this, that for a long time past, we have frequently heard the mysterious lights have been seen moving about of their own accord, apparently, over the farm and around the house and outbuildings of the late Charles Tacky, who was murdered last fall by Peter Pelkey, who was hanged here in February for the crime. Now, for a while, no attention was given them, but so often have people who were passing the Tacky Ranch in the night saw these lights and told about them on their arrival here, that night before last, a party of our citizens, who have the organ of inquisitiveness developed to a little more than the ordinary, concluded to ride down to the ranch and witness for themselves the phenomena, if such there were. One stoic German farmer who lives close by, and who told us his story with all gravity, and whose word we would not think of doubting, for he believes all he says, is sure he saw these lights about the time the snow began to fall. They looked like the light thrown from a red glass lantern at first, but have been growing paler and lighter in color ever since. He is seen from 1 to 4 of an evening moving about the place, some going up as high as 20 feet and moving around in different directions. And sometimes, apparently, settling on the corners of the fence, then moving around the house, the barns, the corrals, and other places, then finally sinking down and disappearing in an instant, leaving only darkness behind. He couldn't think what it was made them do so. Another farmer, who lives near, says he has seen the lights ever since the nights began to close in early last fall. We should believe this man fully if we did not know he takes a good deal too much stimulus sometimes to be a good judge of such wonderful sights as he describes, and thinks his imagination plays tricks. Yet he is truthful and believes what he says. Now, folks, I'm going to stop right there because the man sitting across from the table from me, he likes to take a little too much stimulus, so you got to watch this fellow over here, too. Folks, the gentlemen of Helena who went down to satisfy their curiosity are all sober-minded, reliable men. They were a little belated on account of the bad roads and had got off the direct track a little and arrived there about 10 o'clock. Two of them, who we happened to see first on their return, agreed that as they turned the corner and went into the road which led by the farm, and after riding along the fence, all of a sudden they saw a large bright light moving over the open field, somewhere from 10 to 40 feet above the ground, that it was apparently from 4 to 6 inches in diameter and from 18 to 24 inches high. The body of the light being of an orange color, occasionally flashing off rays of a greenish or sometimes of a bluish tintage, that it moved up and down over the field slowly and gradually sank down and vanished. They also saw two other lights moving around which looked like a lamplight surrounded by a porcelain glove, the body of the light not being visible, but white, mild, and distinct. We have heard of no rational attempt to account for the singular lights seen. Some believe they are connected to the end of the world, which Mother Shipton prophesied will take place this year. Others say they are electric lights that have escaped from Edison's or Brush's laboratories, but they cannot see why they hang around one place so persistently. Others are sure they sent out from hell by the murderer to find the place where the murdered man has buried his money. Not having seen them, we pretend to give no theory. So before we go on, we're talking about 1881. So we're not talking about headlights, folks. We're not talking about headlights of the car.
Right.
We're not talking about... Now, look, you could have said, okay, it's a lantern or it's a campfire reflecting off the horizon. But these guys are talking about they've only noticed it after he was murdered. Charles was murdered. They only noticed it. And how's a campfire reflecting 40 foot off the ground and moving around?
Well, I don't know. And I know that, you know, I've mentioned it before in years gone by that I was hunting one time, yep, and I saw what looked like a green orb about the size of a basketball.
Yeah.
Moving across this field. It was early, early morning. Wasn't quite light out. Wasn't pitch black. It was just before the sun. It's still very dark. And this object was moving about, oh, I don't know, 3 feet off the ground. And what it struck me at first was, what is that? And then I watched it. I wasn't fearful or anything. I noticed it was moving against the wind. It was pretty breezy that morning. So I was like, man, what is that? And it only lasted for about 7 or 8 seconds. This is really the only paranormal experience I've ever had. I didn't think too much about it. Went on with the hunt. Nothing. Never thought nothing about it. Till about 2 weeks later, or maybe it was later that day. I don't remember exactly. But I remember at some other time, my uncle was talking with a guy, and he was talking about... See, there were several stands on this property, and we would each take turns in different ones. Like, mm-hmm, what stand do you want to hunt this morning? So that one guy doesn't get the awesome stand all the time.
Yeah.
Anyways, so this other guy had, it was his turn to sit where I had been sitting. And he was describing a similar thing. And Dave was like, what? What is it? And I overheard him talking about it. And I was like, man, I saw that too. Exactly that. And then it turned out that that was what we believed was an Indian burial ground up there.
Okay.
So it's always made me wonder, much like you're talking about spirits and stuff. And also, of course, I've talked to numerous people that are ghost hunters, seen photos of these orbs and stuff. I'm wondering if that's what it is. It's kind of like the swamp gas theory. I don't believe that these are reflections of a campfire.
Yeah.
I don't believe these are reflections of a lantern or anything.
I mean, I'm sure it can answer, sure, some of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Some, just like them, with all these sightings.
Yeah.
Some of them are simply misidentifications, but other ones are not. I don't know. I like the orbs I like these stories. I've never been to the Marfa Lights. Of course, I've never even been to North Carolina. I would like to see the Brown Mountain Lights and things like that. I find this stuff interesting because so many people see them. And what is a rational explanation for this? Even that lady that sent us that picture off the deer cam trail, some odd looking orbs.
Yeah.
It looks like almost in a tornado.
And nothing else is moving.
No.
That's what I like the most about it. And it was from 2 a.m. There's supposed to be no light out. And there's light coming through the trees, orbs swirling trees. Some of the trees are blurry. Some of them are perfect. Yeah, it's a very odd photo.
Is this ghosts, spirits, or...
Time slip. We saw a time slip.
Some kind of extraterrestrial drone.
That's true.
That they're using as reconnaissance to look around or to interact with people. I mean, even on the newest Independence Day movie, this extraterrestrial thing is actually a giant orb.
Yes.
So I find that, you know, what is that?
Yeah. Well, this goes on. They keep digging. This comes from April 1st of 1881, still again in the Daily Independent there from Helena, Montana. And they talk about, they go get an independent reporter and a few others, and they go back to the ranch. Now, and here's what's cool. That in that writing, on that paper, they actually have this quote. "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy," from Shakespeare. So they put that in, and I love the fact that they put that quote in there, because this goes on. It says, "On Wednesday evening, J.B. Sanford, A.M. Walker, another gentleman whose name is not recalled, and the editor of the Independent, visited the Tacky Ranch with a view to ascertaining for themselves the truth or falsity of the rumors in reference to the mysterious lights which are said to float around the lake residence of Charles Tacky. We arrived at the residence of Mr. Tom Darrington, adjoining the Tacky premises, about 8 o'clock in the evening, and found there several neighbors assembled who were discussing the all-absorbing topic of the wonderful lights. Mr. Darrington, accosting us, said, 'Come to see the lights.' And we acknowledged that such was the fact, and learned from him that every evening parties of sightseers from various portions of the county came in crowds to behold the unaccountable mystery. Mr. Darrington said, 'I don't keep hotel, or I might do a lively business entertaining the sightseers.' Now, the night before, the light had been even more audacious than usual. It had come within about 60 yards of an old neighbor of Mr. Tacky, whose relations had not been of the most amiable nature with the deceased. And, as it seemed bent on approaching him, this gentleman, in self-defense, had raised his gun and fired at it, when the light at once disappeared. It was amusing to hear the assembled neighbors all speak of the strange light as Charles Tacky or him. They seemed to entertain no doubt as to the identity of the mysterious visitor." Now, how strange is that?
Yeah.
They already are like, "That's him. He's come back.
He's come back.
There's some more. They talk about its appearance. They say, according to the statement of the neighbors, it had made its first appearance just before last Christmas, when the ground was covered with snow and was then more brilliant than now. Well, then that makes sense if it was a reflection.
Right, yeah.
It's coming. I get that. In color, it was red and brilliant, resembling the headlight of a locomotive and of about the same size." So right there, okay. Well, maybe we do have a reflection of a locomotive.
That's possible.
Maybe that's it. It says it always wandered around the Tacky farm, sometimes passing over the top of its house. Well, now you can scratch that.
Right. It
says, but usually gliding around the premises a few feet from the ground. Sometimes as many as three lights would be seen in close proximity to each other. They are usually visible for a few moments at a time. Now, sometimes, however, they can be seen for a full half hour, but always disappear as suddenly as they came. Often its disappearance is like a sudden blaze, expiring almost instantly. The neighbors say that at first the lights only appeared every 10th night, but recently they have been appearing every evening between 8 and 10 o'clock. So now you're like, okay, I could understand it if it only appeared every 10th night. Maybe that's when the trains come through. Right?
Right.
But now it's every night between 8 and 10. So I haven't heard anybody talk about, okay, because, you know, they probably didn't think about that. They're too consumed with the fact of what these lights are. But I can't imagine if you're there within 60 yards and it's flying over the house and you're looking at it, what it could possibly be, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's my point.
Not a reflection.
That's definitely not a reflection. The same time exactly every night.
Yes.
I mean, to me, you know, for whatever reason, it seems that ghosts or spirits, or whatever, they do kind of seem like they keep a schedule. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they do,
more
right?
Than one story yeah. where they just yeah. always appear at the same time, same place.
Yeah.
Like it's something on a loop that's yeah. replaying.
It does, well, and that's what's funny. Every 10th night, now it's every night. It seems like it's getting more and more activity
yeah.
the more people are showing up to see it.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
feeding
yeah.
off of those number of people.
Yeah.
They actually have written in here what they call the neighborhood version. It says Tom Darrington, who lives within a few hundred yards of Tacky's house, and the other neighbors account for the mysterious light on the theory that Charlie Tacky was killed so suddenly by Pelkey that he never knew what hurt him and does not know yet that he's dead.
Yeah, right.
And it says that he was perfectly absorbed in his business as a ranchman. And now that spring is opening, the disembodied spirit continues to wander around the premises, intent upon preparations for the cropping season. Now it says, accompanied by Mr. Darrington, our party at once proceeded to the deserted premises of the murdered Tacky. Grim and dark, the outlines of the house and barn arose against the background of the starry sky. We entered the barn and were pointed out to the stall where the murdered man was hidden under the lime. There, by the light of a match, we saw stains of blood still upon the posts of the stall. The boots of the victim still lie in the same position in which they were left some 8 months ago, and a portion of the lime that covered his remains is still visible. About the time of our arrival, another party of five or six ladies and gentlemen from Helena drove up, and soon we were joined by an additional company of gentlemen from the country, making altogether an assembly of some 14 persons, all intent on catching a glimpse of the unearthly visitor. Soon the cry, "There he is, there's Charlie," called us from the barn. Sure enough, a glimmering light, much like that of a lantern, could be seen gliding along an apparent distance of 400 yards from where we stood. Faint and flickering, the gleam shone for a moment, then disappeared again. "That's Charlie," said Darrington solemnly. One gentleman had a double-barreled shotgun, which he leveled and proposed to shoot as soon as the light came within range, but soon no further light could be seen. "Let's get nearer," said many voices, and at the word some five or six gentlemen, including Walker and Darrington and the man with the gun, and Mr. Messers, and the independent reporter, started on a brisk walk in directions from which the light was last visible. So now they're going to it. Now, I know there's not being money made, or at least they're not talking about there being money made. But when you're talking 400 yards, it could easily be somebody with a lantern.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Just trying to draw people. It says, after going some 300 yards, we halted, when suddenly a bright light arose within 100 yards of us, very like the flame of a candle, except a little more intense. Now, here's where it gets interesting. It moved up and down in a zigzag way for an instant and then disappeared. All the party saw it distinctly. Suddenly, some 200 yards further off, another flame appeared, moving rapidly along the ground like a man running with a lighted torch. It moved towards us for an instant, then receded, then circled around. "Watch it," said Darrington. "That's Charlie's light." But soon it was gone. The independent man proposed to step off 100 yards and have one of the party light a match and wave it so as to see the contrast in lights. This was done. But just as the match was lit, another light, not like it, flamed up an equal distance from the independent reporter and the party. All saw the second light and hailed to know who was there, but no answer came. The man with the gun was about to shoot, but the light disappeared before he got his aim. At various intervals, the gliding light could be seen glimmering along the horizon, sometimes at one point, then at another, but always within a radius of a few hundred yards from Tacky's house. The neighbors solemnly informed us that no such lights were visible before last winter. Many of them had lived in the neighborhood for 12 years. They had often gone to the place where the lights were visible when the snow was on the ground last winter to see if there were any sign of human footsteps in the snow. but were never able to see any indications of the presence of mortal agency in creating the strange illuminations.
Wow.
So they can't find footsteps.
Yeah.
They can't. It's popping up all around them at this point. What is it? Was the general query of the curious crowd who had seen for themselves the marvelous light. It's Charlie, was the general verdict of the neighbors. It's phosphorescent light, said a few skeptics. But the surrounding ground is high and dry, and whoever saw phosphorescent light in the winter with a thermometer 30 degrees below zero and the ground covered in snow? Nobody. It's a lot of mischievous rascals who were hoaxing the country, said a third party. But who would try to carry out a hoax at the risk of life when men armed with rifles and shotguns are blazing away at the mysterious visitor when it appears?
Yeah, right. I mean, that's the thing. They want to shoot at the light.
Exactly. Now, a classical gentleman suggests that the blood of Charlie Tacky should be washed away from the stall where he fell at his time of murder last fall. You know, gentlemen, he said, that the ancients had a tradition that until a body was decently interred, the discontented ghost was unable to cross the Styx and continued to wander around among the habitations of men. Wash away the bloodstains and remove Tacky's boots from the stable. Perhaps that will allay the troubled spirit. Others thought that the deceased, who was a money-saving man, had buried treasure still hidden on the ranch, and that search should be instituted at once. So without arriving at any conclusion, the company, about 10 o'clock, dispersed for their several homes. Perhaps men of science can explain the strange phenomena on scientific principles. If so, let the public have the benefit of their suggestions. Certainly these illuminations, if the united testimony of the neighborhood is to be believed, are full of mystery and deserve the closest scrutiny and investigation. So we're going to go back into now the whole thing with Peter Pelkey, because now they're kind of talking about, all right, let's see what this is. So this comes again from 1881, you know, and we're talking about from March and from April. They're talking about all this stuff that takes place there in Helena. Now, you're going to get a kick out of this. This is actually, some people are leaning to the fact that maybe it's the murderer himself, not the murdered person, but the murderer. And they talk about this. One of the most gruesome murders recorded in Lewis and Clark County occurred in September of 1880. Authorities discovered the crime when they went to check on Charles Tacky, who had a ranch 4 miles east of Helena in the Prickly Pear Valley. Tacky's brother had reported him missing. An awful stench led authorities to the rancher's body, his corpse buried under several barrels of lime. An axe clotted with blood lay buried by the victim, or with the victim. Tufts of hair and pools of blood revealed how the killer had dragged the body to its final resting place. The subsequent arrest, trial, and hanging of Peter Pelkey led to a series of ghostly visitations visited by hundreds of local residents. Peter Pelkey was a 24-year-old French-Canadian who drifted from the lumber camps of Maine to New Hampshire and Minnesota before ending up in Tacky's employment. Tacky was something of a recluse, a thrifty bachelor who lived in a very old log cabin despite his prosperity. Pelkey and Tacky made a strange combination but seemed to get along well. According to Pelkey's testimony, he and Tacky were in the log stable catching hogs. Tacky bent down to grab one as Pelkey picked up the axe to toss it out of the way, and he accidentally hit Tacky on the head, causing a wound that bled profusely. The sight of blood made Pelkey crazy. He struck Tacky twice more over the head, killing him. Pelkey feared the hogs would eat his body, Tacky's, so he dragged the dead man into the manger, poured 2 barrels of lime over him, and then it says here, when Pelkey noticed one of Tacky's feet sticking out of the lime, he took up the axe and chopped it off, then jumped on it to bury it in the lime as well. Now, Pelkey rifled through Tacky's pockets, took the money he could find, made his getaway. But there was a witness to this business. Tacky's horse, this fine stallion, they write, stabled next to the lime-covered corpse, had seen the murder. Pelkey saddled this animal, intending to ride for Fort Benton, but the horse refused to cooperate, they believe, due to the loyalty of his dead master. The horse snapped and bit at the rider's legs until Pelkey had to kneel in the saddle to protect himself. Although Pelkey beat the horse mercilessly, it would only move in fits and starts. It took them all night to travel 18 miles. Pelkey finally reached the Dearborn, training the horse for a swifter mount. Authorities soon identified the horse's tackies, followed Pelkey's trail, and arrested him. It says once incarcerated there in the Lewis and Clark County Jail in Helena, Father Lawrence D. Paldino visited Pelkey and found him to be seemingly stoic, stupid, and devoid of human feelings. Then Pelkey had a strange experience. It says one night as he lay wide awake on his cot, he saw a sudden blinding light in the corner of his cell that struck terror in his heart. It says when it dissipated, Pelkey was transformed. The guards corroborated this story, noticing immediately that Pelkey no longer spoke in grunts, but with articulated intelligence. He was sentenced to hang, and on February 4th, that morning of 1881, says a crowd thronged about the jail yard, packing so densely onto the surrounding shed rooftops that several roofs collapsed. And half past 11, a blanket-wrapped coffin was placed under the scaffold, and they brought Pelkey out of the jail at 11:45. The crowd fell silent. Pelkey bowed and nodded to several, of course, in the crowd. They read his death warrant. Officers escorted him to the gallows. The restraints were applied. The noose was adjusted. The signal was given. Says the sheriff cut the cord, springing the iron trap, and Pelkey fell through. His heart beat for 14 minutes, and at 16 minutes, they pronounced him dead, his neck broken by the fall.
Right.
Now, it says, wild rumors about strange lights appearing on Tacky's deserted ranch, that's when they begin to spread. It says newspapers, of course, covered these incidences. And then, of course, they talk about that could have been Native Americans because they said that they had seen some stuff along those lines. But others believe that the phenomenon was the ghost of Peter Pelkey looking for Tacky's wealth, this alleged wealth. And then some believe it was the ghost of Charles trying to protect his all of his property from this. So they go into this. And it says the witnesses still agreed that all these lights around all these areas only started showing up after all this happened, after every bit of this took place. So it wasn't like they were seeing a few before.
Right.
They just were like, look, Native Americans in this area have reported seeing these lights, but never in this area. This just sprang up out of nowhere. But the father, Father Paladino, admitted that when he and his colleagues were asked their opinions about the lights, that they would allude to the fact that someone who wanted to buy the ranch had simply made up the story to scare off other buyers. And he says this, years later, the father concluded this, we must candidly confess that the strange occurrence has ever been and still is to this day an unsolved riddle in our mind.
Wow. That's
so
crazy.
That's what makes me leave when I start thinking about these ghost lights is they only really began to see them after Charles died. Now, of course, it wasn't long enough to say that they only appeared before they caught Pelkey. But at least Pelkey reports seeing this bright light. So it almost makes you believe that it's Charles still there and he's guarding what's his until, you know, who knows how long he's there. Maybe. The sad thing is you never can find any, like, wrap up. You never do know.
Yeah.
Did they clean up the mess? Did they take his boots and inter them with him? What did they do? Because you got to think about back in this time. If you were a bachelor and you owned all that and you died, you were murdered, well, who got your stuff? People just took it.
People just took it.
There was nobody to give it to. The people just back then would just take it. So they would put it up for sale, and then I guess they would give the money to the church. Or, you know, I don't know who got the money. You know, you would have no idea. So they sold off all of his land, and you know they were buying it for pennies on the dollar.
Yeah.
Or was it somebody thinking, you know what? Let's scare them off. Let's make it where somebody doesn't want to buy this. Either way, it's extremely interesting. And folks, if all of you, everybody out there in America or wherever you're at right now, when you're doing some traveling, especially at night where you can see these lights, keep your eyes out there. Keep your eyes peeled. I'd like to know if y'all come across any of them. Let's take a break. We'll come back on the other side and wrap this puppy up, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
Thank you.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. I love those types of stories with the orbs and the ghostly things, and especially those where there's a twist on what possibly could have happened. Very interesting stuff. Did you see this over the weekend? Now, for you non-elite members, last Elite Show, last Thursday, talked about a guy and his sister who crossed this barricade over there in Yellowstone National Park and accidentally, they think, fell into this pool of boiling hot water and acid, and you know, he expired because of that. Here's another toxic thing, but not as dangerous, but still quite similar in story. This happened over here in the United States in San Jose, California. Did you see this? It's called what they're calling it in the media as a toxic blob takeover, where this giant dangerous foam mountain engulfed this town. Now, a massive toxic foam mountain, they say, which could contain dangerous chemicals, took over the entire streets. But many mistook the dangerous spill as a public foam party. So people were playing in this stuff. They said the police desperately urged the public to stay away from the 10-foot-tall mountain of foam. But many got in it and were playing in it and stuff. Now, this bobbing sea of white foam overwhelmed vehicles, residential roads, leaving many who ventured in covered from head to toe in this strange substance. If you go on YouTube, you can find it. If you go on any kind of social media, I'm sure you've seen photos of it. Or you can look if you want. Or, of course, I'll put links to it in the show notes. But officials later clarified that this malfunction in a fire alarm is what caused it. And this new hangar at a nearby San Jose airport in California accidentally caused the release of billowing mountains of this giant foam. Now, they say gallons of this fire retardant flooded the whole 60-foot hangar and all the surrounding town. And what they were warning people is this stuff has potentially dangerous chemicals in it, and it's not good to get on your skin. But these people were playing in it and partying in it like this was some kind of this is like a club party. And then later they said that there was a lot of people that had outbreaks of a skin irritant. You know, their skin was itchy and, mm-hmm. and turned them red. And there was a lot of
not
people
supposed
that,
to be in there.
A lot of people were hospitalized by this foam. And I saw that, and it, man, it reminded me of the toxic pools that young unfortunate man fell into. What do you think of this giant foam takeover? I mean, it looks pretty crazy from there. One of the people said they were driving home, and they're like, what? Did it snow here today?
Yeah, right.
And then as they get closer, they're like, that's not snow.
It's 10 foot deep. It's taking over the tops of vehicles. It's rolling over the top of, like, fire trucks, just covering the tops of them.
It's crazy.
You don't want that on you. But see, it's everybody's first inclination is it's just bubbles. But it's not. It's not just bubbles.
That's exactly
right. That stuff's a chemical in there, too. You know, it's made to snuff out oxygen. So there's no more fire.
Yeah.
So you don't want to be horse-assing around in this flame-retardant bubbles.
No, I need to ask my brother about it. He's a fireman. I know we have several firemen that listen to the show,
yes.
Even if we're all even across the great pond, as they
yes.
call it. And so maybe they can give me some insight into what this retardant
They'll tell you
is.
Straight up, don't play in that stuff.
Right?
Yet there's people out there like, yeah, man, it's party time.
Yeah,
party right. time. You know why? Because it's recreational marijuana passed in California.
Yeah, maybe.
California.
Maybe. Well, you know,
they went crazy. They got all smoked out and they're running around in flame retardant bubbles.
Yeah, maybe. Well, not just marijuana. I recently was watching a documentary on Gaia, our sponsor.
Oh, here we go. Yeah.
And it's called Psilocybin's Mushroom Explorer with Simon G. Powell. Now, this woman named Regina Meredith, she interviews this guy, Simon G. Powell. And it's pretty cool because he talks about his profound connections to the natural world and the spiritual world brought on by these psilocybin mushroom experience. He said after graduating in UCL in 1992, he suffered from an extended bout of what he calls mushroom fever.
Whoa.
And he was using these mushrooms exclusively for a long time. And it's pretty interesting because he's gone on to write several books, including The Psilocybin Solution, Darwin's Unfinished Business, The Magic Mushroom Explorer. He's actually made two documentary films called Mana and Metanoia. And another one, it doesn't give the name of it here. But it's over on Gaia, and it's about an hour long, and it's very interesting. His views of what these mushrooms, you know, so many people are talking about how, of course, not abusing it, but by taking these small doses of psilocybin mushrooms mm-hmm. and other experiences, it actually helps you. There's spiritual benefits to it. And it thinks that lots of our ancient cultures were always doing it, and the people today we just don't do it anymore because it's been demonized and it's not really a bad thing. This is why these people are traveling to the Amazon to do ayahuasca, things like that. What are your thoughts on these mushroom trips that a lot of people are encouraging people to take?
Look, I'm thumb up. I'm down with them. Okay. I'm a big fan, but they're not for everybody. It's the same as taking caffeine. It's the same as sugar.
Absolutely,
it's the same as everything. It's not for everybody. This isn't something that, look, you and I have discussed this before. As kids, you and I, young men, we fooled around with it. And you probably weren't prepared for what you should have been going into. Whereas at an older date, it's as you get older, it's like everything else, you're more prepared. You kind of know what you're getting out of this whole deal. I would suggest anybody that's very interested in it to really take a good long look, do your research, really, before you just jump off with both feet. This isn't something to be taken lightly. The idea of taking it lightly has gotten us to the point of where we are now with the prohibition of all of these chemicals and all of these you could even call them plant medicines, because it's an all-natural substance. So, look, I'm a fan. But also, too, it has to be done for a reason. You don't just go in there for, it's not like you just go have a beer. You don't just go down and go, I'm not really doing much this evening. You know, I'm going to go have two or three beers. No, you don't just sit down and go, I'm going to have 4 or 5 grams of shrooms. You know, you don't do that. That's not how you approach this. So, I mean, I think it can be good, but it's not for everyone. It's not for the young.
I'm not saying that. But I don't think it's as negative as the people want to make it out to be. Because I don't know anybody that's had a negative shroom experience. Do you?
You can have scary experiences. I know people that have had some really frightening things. But it's always one of those deals where you come back out of it and you're like, oh, man, that was, you know, a day or so later. You're like, oh, but that can be that way with anything. I mean, I've had some really bad experiences with drinking, so.
Right? Yeah, just like that. But it was very interesting.
Put your hands behind your back, sir. Thumbs up. Thank you.
And it's on Gaia.
Watch your head.
And it's on Gaia.com. It's very cool. Also, if you like George Norrie, Coast to Coast, there's a series on there called Beyond Belief. There's 242 episodes of that. Very interesting. My favorite, of course, is this Deep Space series that's in the Seeking Truth section of Gaia.com. But also, they also have lots of other films and documentaries and yoga and things like that, transformation, much, much more. It's a streaming service. You can join it. Cam, what is your thoughts on it?
I love it. If you look, your first month will be 99 cents. Give it a whirl. Jump on there. Sign up. Get your first month. See what you think. Check it all out. There's so much stuff on here. I can't help it, man. I get tied up with all that. I don't even have a favorite. I keep saying, you know, the last few months, I was like, oh, yeah, I got a favorite. Or this is the one I've been watching. This one I really love. I can't say that anymore, man. Right. I can't say that anymore. Look, I've watched the episode of DMT and the Ark of the Covenant with Graham Hancock because I had to go. Anything that Graham says, I love to watch. All that. It's a great episode. Thumb up. Great episode, man. I can't help it. If you just want to dabble, just get on here and dabble.
Yeah, there's like, several more that I'm planning on watching. There's
Can go deep. You can go for an hour or you can go for 30 minutes. You can just find little ones that you want to go. It's wonderful. I love it.
There's the one on there I haven't watched yet, but I'm going to. The Mystery of the Black-Eyed Children. There's another one called Hunting Bigfoot with Rettman Mullis.
Don't watch The Mystery of the Black-Eyed Children. There's no mystery. They're just evil. Quit. You're going to invite them into your house.
I love that kind of stuff. Well, we know it's Thanksgiving here in the United States. Lots of people are going to be traveling. People that are listening to my voice right now are actually on their way traveling. Cam, you mentioned on the Elite Show that you're going to be staying home. You don't have to do any traveling. I've only got a short distance to go. But I love this time of year because, you know, I don't know. I just love Thanksgiving. The time between Halloween and Christmas is like my favorite. And not just are we celebrating Thanksgiving this week, but we're celebrating a birthday.
We are celebrating a birthday.
Cam?
Oh, Lord.
Birthday is coming up on the 26th.
Yep.
And do you have any plans with your family about celebrating that?
I don't know. I figure we'll all go out. You got to find somebody to watch the kids. We're all going to go out like we did last time.
That sounds really
good. Let's go get us something to eat. We'll go take some beers.
I need some sushi.
All right. I'm down. That's it. Plans made. We're going sushi.
Just like that.
That's how grown-ups do it. Okay. Kyle brought it up. So it is written, so shall it be done.
Yeah, right. That was easy. If you'd like to share your experiences with Expanded Perspectives, don't forget you can email the show, as always, at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can now call the show if you'd like, 817-945-3828.
He's turned it back on.
If you'd like to, we'd really appreciate it if you'd go over to iTunes and write us a review. That always helps out the show. And don't forget about signing up for Elite. That's about all the time we have. For everybody out there in America, have a wonderful Thanksgiving. For everybody else, just have a wonderful week. For you Elite members, we'll be speaking again to you on Thursday. For everybody else, we'll talk to you next Monday. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Pass out hugs this week, folks. Peace. We'll be right back.
heart.